Okay, we are officially being recorded for this session, so we'll start off with a CIDR announcement from Philip Watland.
Yeah, thanks very much, Lynn. I just want to bring to people's attention, if they're not aware, that we're having our fourth CIDR workshop in conjunction with the CNIE conference in Banff, Alberta. And this year's theme is focused on the use of the Internet to support distance ed research activities. We have a number of presenters that are shown there on the slide. The website for the conference is shown there as athabasca.ucne-rcie, and of course the CIDR website, which I'm sure most people know. The topics being presented this year include weaving the web in doctoral study at a distance, research in cyberspace, current trends in internet research, web strategies for collaborative writing, wikis, blogs as tools for research data collection, and telecollaboration tools for delocalized research teams. The conference itself, as well as the workshop, takes place at Banff Park Lodge, and we've had quite good response for the conference and the workshop, and hopefully we'll be able to see you there. And as you can see, we have a number of well-known presenters at the session as well. That's it. Thanks very much, Lynn. Back to you.
Well, I'd like to just start by welcoming everybody here today. And before I hand this over, I have another quick announcement. I just want to remind everybody that the CIDR sessions are recorded and available from the CIDR site. The PowerPoint presentation will also be available from the site and an MP3 recording. And I'll just put the link to the I'll have to put the link in for the site a little later, okay? And I'm going to go ahead now and introduce our presenter today, Tanis Morgan. Tanis is an instructional development consultant at BCIT and a PhD candidate in language and literature and education at UBC. Prior to coming to BCIT, she worked as a course developer for online programs at the Center for Distance Education and Technology at UBC. She has conducted workshops and taught online locally and internationally. In this presentation, Tanis is going to be sharing with us her doctoral research that looks at cases of teaching presence in international online distance courses. Tanis will be stopping periodically to invite discussion, and at that time, we encourage you to click on the microphone in the bottom left corner of your screen if you have any questions or comments. And if someone else is speaking at that time, you can use the hands up button in the participant box to indicate that you would like to speak next. If you don't have audio capabilities today, you can also type messages in the text box. Actually, you can do that at any time, and I'll try to bring those questions and comments to Tanis's attention. So I will stop my chatter now and let Tanis have the floor. Thank you, Tanis, for giving your time to present today.
Thanks, Lynn, and thanks everybody for showing up. It's the first time I've done one of these, and I have to say it's a lot more nerve-wracking than just standing up in front of a room and talking about this. So hopefully this will not be too confusing, or hopefully it'll actually fit in well with the time as well. So as Lynn mentioned, this is part of my doctoral research, and actually first I should make sure that you can actually hear me. Hang on a sec. Okay, good. I see a smiley. So this is part of my doctoral research, and I should mention too that I'm actually in the process of just preparing for my defense. So I really welcome any critical comments or questions that you have. It will really benefit me and help me think through some things a little bit better. So just to begin, I guess you could say that I think this research is a bit of a convergence between my work experience as an online course developer and also as an instructor and a student of online courses. And it started out actually as a study on social presence. And what happened is when I looked at one particular online course in greater detail and I began conducting interviews with students and with the instructor, what was what was becoming really interesting was that the student feedback was pointing to the importance of teaching presence. So really, the more interesting piece was becoming the teaching presence piece. And it helped that this course was a bit unusual in that the instructor had a very unique teaching presence. But I guess you could say his teaching presence could be described really as a sage on the stage type of approach. And I found it interesting that even though he had adopted that approach, he was getting really good feedback from the students. So what I intended to do was to use the community of inquiry tool and do some content analysis. And I thought that, you know, by doing some interviews with the students and the instructors, it would offer some sort of triangulation. And what happened in that process as well was that the narrative around the whys of the instructor post, the instructor interaction, was really interesting. And it led me to start recording my own sort of think aloud, which is a procedure used for data collection, for my own instructor interactions, because I was actually teaching online at the same time. And what sort of came out of that was that in some cases where I had asked the instructor to talk a little bit about why they posted, it wasn't really very obvious or very visible using the actual community of inquiry tool as to why the instructor had made that in the whole sort of thinking process behind their posts. So I became more interested really at getting at how do you get at the whys of teaching presence, and I found that Tsang, who is a researcher in English as a second language teaching, he coined a term, I think it's his anyways, called interactive decisions. So really it was just getting at the interactive decisions of instructors as they're teaching online, and in particular in international contexts where the variables are a little bit different potentially than in local contexts. So basically what the review of the literature, let me go back a little bit here. So one of the things that came out of language education research, and this is actually my background, I'm interested in the non-native speakers of English, that's the NNSE here on the slide, how they were participating in online graduate courses or even just face-to-face courses. And Keisha Lim's dissertation from 2005 really pointed to an interesting example of two online courses where one course, by the nature of the structure and the instructor, led to the near marginalization of some of the non-native speakers of English. And there were a bunch of reasons for that, but it was quite interesting. And the other course, on the other hand, which had a different instructor and different type of structure, different setup and that sort of thing, the same students didn't have that issue at all. And Naoka Morita also did a dissertation on non-native speakers of English and their participation in face-to-face contexts. And what that pointed to was really the complexity of student participation in various graduate contexts. Now, what was interesting about these two studies were that they both adopted sociocultural frameworks, which in language education is quite the thing right now. And some of you might have already encountered those. Leben-Wenger is considered to be a sociocultural framework, but also activity theory, which seems to be increasing in interest, is also part of that sociocultural group of frameworks. I wonder if I should stop here and ask some questions. No, I'll go through this first. So let me just back up a bit. One of the reasons why I saw these social culture frameworks in these two dissertations as being really important was that it led me to reflect a little bit on distance education research, and in that, you know, there was a bit of a paradox that despite the increasingly global nature of online programs and offerings, where, you know, sometimes students and instructors aren't participating in their first language, and where students and instructors may or may not share the same local context or environment, there hadn't been too much concern for this and in talking about online learning communities. So I felt that, you know, perhaps it was important and relevant that if you're talking about community and creating community where interaction and participation is emphasized, that it was probably worthwhile just exploring whether these had some influence or whether there was some connection there. So my research questions were, how do instructors negotiate their teaching presence in online contexts, and specifically here, international online contexts, and what are the constraints and affordances that influence this negotiation? And constraints and affordances is sociocultural framework language, you know, basically advantages and disadvantages, if you prefer. So I adopted, right up front, I adopted activity theory as a framework, and this is third generation activity theory here that I'm showing you, and it's attributed to Engstrom, but activity theory is basically, it traces its lineage back to Vygotsky, and of course it's through Vygotsky via Leontiev, Luria, and now Engstrom. It's been shaped in various ways. And basically it represents a series of interconnecting triangles, and some of the key things about activity theory really is that the main thing is that your unit of analysis changes with activity theory. What's really important is that the unit of analysis is the subject with an object and these mediating components. Instruments sometimes called tools, rules, community, and division of labor. And this system is constantly shifting, and there's always tensions occurring, contradictions occurring between components, and it's a very dynamic system. But the existence of these tensions and contradictions isn't necessarily a negative thing, since that's what leads to change and transformation. So just to put that into a little bit more of a concrete perspective, because I recognize that that's a very Coles Notes version of activity theory, how I conceptualized that for this study was you had the instructor whose object was was teaching presence with the outcome of achieving a community of inquiry or a community or whatever you prefer. And within this system, there were the community was composed of, in this case, co-instructors, as you'll see a bit later, students. The tools to consider in this environment were obviously the course environment, the CMS, whatever sort of technology tools, etc., and the language of instruction. And rules were expectations of the institution, expectations of students, conceptualization of the course and context, and I added here own instructor identity, which I'll explain a bit later. And of course, division of labor is determined by course approach, shared roles, and responsibilities. Perhaps this is a good opportunity right here to just stop and ask if there's any questions, because I find it really difficult to actually do a good job of articulating activity theory.
Well, I actually think you've done a great job of articulating the activity theory, and I love the more practical approach you gave on this slide. But I'm going to invite anyone just to click on the microphone in the bottom left-hand corner with questions or comments, or you can text those.
Should I continue then? Are we good to go?
Hi, Candice. It's Philip. I just to give you some feedback, I think that you've presented it really well. I'm somewhat familiar with activity theory, and I think that probably once you get past this bit into the next section, there'll probably be more questions that I might have, but thanks so much so far.
Good. Thank you very much. I'll continue then, and then, of course, there will also be hopefully ample opportunity for questions after as well. I can always come back to these slides. So to continue, I felt like I should probably describe a little bit why my rationale of adopting activity theory as a framework as opposed to something else, a non-sociocultural theory, I guess. And what I had noticed is that in doing my review of literature that on the online teaching side, the research that research has largely described online teaching in terms of functions and roles, and of course we can refer to Burge, I think 1995 for that, Goodyear, Affair, and Salmon. And there is, of course, the community of inquiry framework, and specifically teaching presence, which I see really as a big step forward from that role describing, in that teaching presence in this case is being seen to be an essential component of a community of inquiry. And in this way, I think it provides a broader, more contextualized view of online teaching, where social presence, cognitive presence, and teaching presence are interdependent. So, but what I found interesting was that the tool that's the community of inquiry tool is predominantly used with content analysis. And And I find that content analysis methods perhaps limit the focus to cataloging interactions and perhaps has neglected a closer look at the contextual conditions of teaching. So put that into, I guess, another person's perspective here, Fung Hanel does research on student teachers and their transfer to practices, and she says here that her rationale really seems to reflect my own, which is by taking into account the interactions between people involved in activity, structures within the activity takes place, and conventions in which it is based and artifacts used, I was able to ground my study in the broad context and capture practice as socially situated rather than simply evidence in actions or performance. So I think that's really where I'm coming from for the study. There's going to be some additional concepts that I'm going to talk about. These we talked about quite a bit in language education research that adopts a sociocultural perspective, and specifically identity, and that one's a bit of a hot potato, but perhaps we'll get to that later, positioning and global contact zones. And I won't go into detail about those right now because they'll probably come up later. So for methodology, because I adopted activity theory as a framework, it had certain methodological implications, and that's, without going into big detail, that's described quite a bit in my dissertation. It's probably the biggest chapter, and multi-case study with cross-case analysis was what I thought really was the best approach for achieving my objective and the purpose of my study. And here I use STAKE 2006, which was well-timed in terms of the publication. And he has some really helpful worksheets to help you work through the whole process of cross-case analysis. And I refer to those quite a bit, and it definitely facilitated the task. Partly because I actually have six cases of instructor teaching presence. So here the cases of are instructor teaching presence. And the unit of analysis that was adopted were the courses they were teaching. So that's basically the framework for that. And data varied between cases, but generally it involved, with the exception of the two stars there, all cases had at least these top data sources. 2 to 3 interviews with the instructor, form transcripts, course documents, interviews with program directors, and interview with co-instructors. In 5 of these 6 cases, it was actually cases of instructors teaching with somebody else at the same time in the same course. So co-instructors definitely show up here a lot. And in one of the cases, I also had permission for student course evaluations and student questionnaires. Because I was dealing with the international context here, the ethics, navigating the whole ethics thing was actually a little bit tricky. And one of the limitations of the study is that I wasn't able to always get student feedback or student evaluations and that sort of thing. But and when I was able to get it, obviously it helped a lot. But that was one of the constraints of this study. And, of course, in keeping with the methodology, triangulation was extremely important. So here I made sure I had multiple sources of data, even though the interviews with the instructors constituted the main source, the starting point for the analysis. And I tried to have a minimum of 2 sources of evidence for each claim that I was making. I also used member checking, so after I wrote up each case, I sent it to the instructor and gave them an opportunity to give feedback and to see whether they felt my interpretation was inaccurate, et cetera. And I also adopted peer debriefing with colleagues and with my supervisor. So let me see, maybe this is a good point and I'll go through this and I'll ask if there's any questions. So there are 3 contexts here. The first one was a Master's of Education at a Canadian university. And here I have 2 courses that were the focus of 2 cases. So here we have case William, who was teaching a narrative inquiry course. It was a 3-week intensive course, so basically 15 weeks had been compressed into 3. And there was a course called Text and Technology, which was 13 weeks. And both of these form part of the same online master's degree. And the reason I consider this an international context, which of course is a relative term, is because this master's, being an online master's of education, it attracted a very international student audience. The second context was an online academy in Eastern Europe. Online academy is the title I've given to this. and it was a postgraduate certificate in e-learning, and there were three courses that formed part of, contributed to four of these cases. So e-learning design, foundations of e-learning, and e-learning tutoring. So as you'll see, e-learning tutoring involves two cases. So there we're looking at the perspective of two instructors. And the last context was an online Masters of Distance Education at a South American university. And there, again, there's a co-teaching situation with a teaching and learning series, which it was an intensive four-week course. So the whole collection looks like this. The grayed out people there are the co-instructors who were interviewed but did not actually form a case in the study for various reasons. The yellow are female, the blue are male, and when there's two people in a little circle, that means that that was a co-instructor situation. So you'll see that there's actually only one case where there was an instructor who wasn't co-teaching. So maybe I'll see if there's any questions right now. Does that mean I'm really clear or something? I guess I'll just keep going on then. Okay, so let me just find my space here. Next slide. So I'm going to do this a little bit backwards here and present right away the cross-case findings. And the ones that are in blue are the ones I'm actually going to talk about in more detail for this presentation. I know there's not a lot of time, so I had to do some selection here. So the first one that I have here is conceptualization of the of interaction. Okay, so the conceptualization, how the instructor conceptualized their interaction or the purpose and goals of the discussion forum or whatever the interaction space was, had an effect on teaching presence. And I'm going to be talking about that with an example. Identities and positioning influence teaching presence. Again, I'll talk about that one. And tools, of course, tools. I mean, I think that's almost should be obvious. But language and technology, which are the two tools I identified here, shape teaching presence. But additionally, the community, so if we refer back to that activity theory framework, the negotiation of teaching presence occurred at the level of students and co-instructors. So both students and co-instructors had an influence on teaching presence in the sense that it had to be negotiated. And in the rules component, the course design shaped teaching presence. But again, that one to me was a little bit obvious. Of course design is going to shape teaching presence. And agency, which is an important concept in sociocultural theory, was evident in all cases. Agency is just simply defined as the sociocultural capacity to act. So individuals are either constrained or when individuals are constrained within an environment to act, they can or do or sometimes don't exercise their agency to sort of get through that. That's probably the best way I can explain it. So to start, the conceptualization of interaction and teaching presence. So how the instructor viewed the purpose and goals of the interaction spaces. So here, again, the blue is what I'll get into more detail, but you'll notice that I was one of the cases. I forgot to mention that. And for me, the purpose and goal was to develop community. For Linda, it was it was an activity space. William conceived it as an online graduate seminar with the purpose of individualized teaching. For Daniel, he didn't really say, but he said it felt like an online classroom. And for Joanne, it was community in the making. And for John, he approached it as an online classroom. So already this was quite interesting to me that even though these courses, which all were built on constructivist types ideas, they were designed, they could be said to have a constructivist type of design, and all where the discussion forum in required student participation and instructor interaction, that sort of thing. Even though they all adopted that, that's what they all had in common, the instructors themselves actually conceived of the spaces very differently, and that ultimately, in some ways, determined their teaching presence. So to give you an example, I think William is probably the best example of this. You'll recall that William was teaching a three-week intensive course. And William was a seasoned professor. He had about 35 years of teaching experience. He had taught online quite a bit, actually, in both mixed mode and online. And William actually, yes, Lynn, he did actually design his course, which isn't the case of all of them. And you'll see that William had 247 posts in 3 weeks. And overall, all the 11 students contributed 1094. So just to put that in perspective, the least active student participated 35 times, whereas the most active student had 127 posts. So you'll see that William had almost twice as much as that. So if you were to just look at this, you would say William is maybe a bit of a sage on the stage. However, William, in talking with William, it became more clear that actually that he was actually a very dedicated constructivist, and he realized this through, he thought that conceptualizing a course and the interaction spaces and online graduate seminar was the best way to achieve his constructivist objectives, his beliefs about teaching and learning. And he did this through highly individualized teaching. So obviously one of the problems of this is that it's extremely time consuming, because how William actually saw individualized teaching was that he was teaching 11 mini courses. So each student was addressed as an individual, and he sort of taught individually to that student, which is one of the reasons why he had so many postings, because he actually always made sure that nobody's messages got left straggling there, even though students, of course, were also responding. It wasn't, you know, an authoritarian type of teaching presence. And basically, let me just see if the next slide sort of gets into this. It was partly also a function of the course design. So I've worked in distance education for a while, and I'd never really seen a course like his where he had no content. It was just a syllabus, scheduled readings, and two class texts. These were actually textbooks that the students had to buy. There was a discussion forum with one topic. There was no separation of topics in the discussion forum. And there was also a key element of this was this development of a language culture autobiography, which I'll talk about a bit later. But William's course was really unusual. And what showed from this was that when I looked at the student feedback, the students were unanimously appreciative of William's approach. They felt that they'd never had a course where there was so much instructor presence. They felt his instructor presence was very productive. And there weren't any comments or any hints that William dominated this course at all. So I guess in Moore's terms, it would be, you know, low structure, high dialogue type of a course, and it worked for the students in this case. Maybe I'll just quickly ask if there's any questions.
Sorry, I put my mic up. I just was thinking how interesting the individual ideas of constructivism are. I mean, in this case, it's really individual learning as opposed to constructivism. And I'm wondering, you know, how much you can measure the personality factors when you're looking into the teaching presence in these situations, because obviously William had that going for him.
Well, William actually thought he was being like a true constructivist, because he thought that his idea of constructivism was based a lot on Vygotsky's ideas, and you know that he as a, you know, an expert was going to mediate their learning, and he had no problems with that whole idea that he was actually the expert. He even said, you know, I've got 35 years of teaching experience. I've been a full professor for X number of years. You know, this is me, and why wouldn't I use that? And so I'm not sure if that answers your question, but you know, in terms of personality, I think we'll be talking a little bit about that in terms of identity, which is coming up next, because sociocultural theory doesn't really refer to personality, because it's, you know, a little bit too individual. It tends to use identity as a concept. Is that good? Should I continue, or are there any other questions?
It's a quiet group today, Tanis. I noticed it prior to when the start of the presentation, so go ahead.
Okay, I'll continue then. I see I've got about 10 minutes left, I think. So, okay, so in terms of identity, I'll just say up front here that identity is a really problematic concept, because nobody has really operationalized it, and it comes from many sources, psychology, sociology, education. Everybody's talking about identity these days. But I'll simply just refer to language education researcher Duff and Uchida, researchers, I guess. And they basically, when they did a study on teacher identity of teachers teaching English in Japan, And what they found is that teachers' perceptions of their social cultural identities were deeply rooted in their personal histories based on past educational, professional, and cross-cultural experiences. So basically what I'm saying here is that these instructors obviously brought their own identities to their course context. And we can see that in how they conceptualized the course context. You know, but William's approach was clearly based on his personal, you know, history as a professor, his own identity as a professor, and his many years of experience. So that's basically where I'm coming at for this discussion. But I also want to mention that, you know, in true sociocultural theory, there's also the influence of the actual environment in which instructors are functioning. So there is a negotiation between, I guess you could say, the self and the collective. And Twistleton offers a nice explanation, where identity is seen as a central dynamic force that has an impact on the way instructors interpret classrooms, and it leads them to shape the activity system in which they operate. So same kind of thing, the same kind of thing as Duff and Uchida, but also with the conditions that the structure, the environment itself, is also shaping identity. So with that in mind, just a brief sort of summary of the cases and what was found in terms of their instructor identities. We have Daniel, who in terms of his teaching presence, functioned as an engaged participant. Joanne is sort of identified herself as an adult educator. John, who we'll talk about later, really came from this identity as a class leader. Linda's approach was really, you know, she saw herself as an expert guide, William as a knowledgeable professor, and Tanis as a community builder. So just to give you a little bit more context here, what was interesting about this is that most of the tensions that occurred in these instructor cases were when identities came in conflict with some sort of positioning that they weren't able to negotiate. In some cases, they were able to negotiate it. But just to give you an example, there's a couple cases here that both Daniel and Tanis, who felt that they were being given an illegitimate positioning, either by a co-instructor or by the technology itself. I might get to that later, but we have Joanne, who's identity as an adult educator was in conflict with her own role as a course author of the course, so she was more invested in that role and therefore didn't really have a lot of teaching presence. William's approach was that he was being perceived as and positioned as an authoritarian instructor, and he had to adopt a lot of strategies to get around that. And of course, John, who we'll talk about, was positioned by the co-instructor into a subordinate role. So John, just to give you some background on John. John was a university professor formally in a field outside of education, and then he became he went into education, got a master's degree, and he had a lot of face-to-face teaching experience. And he actually taught in his former faculty as a face-to-face instructor. But this was his first experience in teaching online. And he went into this really with this conceptualization, first of all, as an online classroom. And in that, he saw himself as a class leader. So he was really seeing himself as a primary person in helping the students through the activities of the course. But John was also sharing this space with another co-instructor, and the discussion forums were all, they weren't divided, they were all merged. So both instructors were facilitating the discussion forums. And what happened is the co-instructor emerged as a dominant instructor. And John really felt that a lot of this was a result of the co-instructor positioning him in a way as a subordinate. So he found that the co-instructor was using pronouns I and not we. He wasn't being CC'd on emails, and the co-instructor was also quicker to respond to the discussion forum. So what happened is he felt marginalized, and you know, as a result, he actually didn't post very much. If you look at his postings, I think he posted 8% of all the posts versus 18% for the co-instructor. But what was interesting is he also engaged in some counter-positioning. So he says here, I felt a responsibility and I looked for opportunities and tried to make contributions, either big or little, just to have a voice, because whether they viewed me as secondary or not, I thought it was my responsibility to post and make contributions where I could. So that's sort of hinting a little bit at, you know, sometimes he just posted just to post, just to sort of be visible. And he also said that, you know, he really saw his role changing. He viewed his role more as a facilitator, trying to draw people out, having input, and putting his two cents in here and there. But clearly it really wasn't a role of a class leader or a primary instructor. So here we have John and Philip's posting. Philip was a co-instructor. And you'll see that, you know, John initiated very few messages, and his discussion forum postings really reflect this, I guess, this more of a facilitator type of interaction as opposed to a class leader type of interaction. So to continue, the last major finding that I'm going to talk about is the relationship between language and teaching presence. And again, coming from a language education background, to me it's a little bit obvious, but I do think it's worth talking about. I've mentioned William already, so I won't go into that too much, but for here we have a case of Linda and Tanis. So Linda and Tanis Linda was part of two courses. One of them she was sharing with me, and here we were both at one point or another in either of these courses interacting or teaching in our second language. Sorry, my microphone just shifted there, sorry. So we'll talk about Linda, but in Linda we're going to see that Linda was her native language, her first language was Spanish, and her second language was English. And in one of the courses she was teaching in the online academy in Eastern Europe in English, and in the course in South America, obviously she was teaching in Spanish. But what happened is that her teaching in one or the other language resulted in a very different perception of her teaching presence. And this was also closely tied to her identity, as we'll see. So basically, just a little recap here. Linda's case really provided an ideal opportunity because she was teaching in these two courses in two different languages to compare how language of instruction influenced teaching presence. So here in the Metropolitan University, this was a South American course. This is how she felt about her interaction and her identity in relation to that. Just coming from Latin America and knowing the language, I felt this commitment to model and provide the best approach to South Americans. Not that I wasn't doing it in the online academy, but just because I have some sort of patriotic or national or language relationship with those people, and I felt I had a stronger bond with the participants. So that I felt was a really interesting quote. I think there's another one. Oh yeah, so here she's talking a little bit about how English specifically, interacting in English, even though she had, you know, really excellent grasp of English, I mean, nobody would really notice that she was struggling at all, but she actually talks a little bit about how that impacted her teaching presence, and I think it's quite significant. You might see my messages, you know, a bit of who I am, but my messages are half of what I think. Sometimes in English I come up with an idea and I don't have the perfect words, so I step them out of it and I don't even bother putting it in. In Spanish, obviously that never happens. There's always a word I can find. Sometimes it's not that I don't find the word it is and I don't know how to write or spell it. It just deters me from writing and that stays out of my posting. So I do believe my postings in Spanish are much more direct and much more humorous or much more who I am than in English. So let me go back just to put a little closing comment to this. To me, this really showed how language in conjunction with an instructor's identity really, to some degree, was shaping their presence. So, you know, in this case, Linda was posting, deferring, not posting certain things because she would just not be able to word it in a certain way. And she even felt that, you know, in Spanish, she adopted a different type of teaching presence. And the transcripts actually do reflect that. She does have a bit of a different style in the Spanish situation as opposed to the online academy, the Eastern European situation. And of course, that's described more in more detail in dissertation, and there is more evidence of that. So lastly, I'm just going to talk really quickly about the technology component. Technology, unsurprisingly, also really shaped teaching presence. And I think the case of Linda and myself is a really big one, because in all of these other cases, WebCT was the CMS, which was kind of unusual actually to find so many courses that were all using the same CMS. But in the the South American context, it was actually the institution's own CMS. And the way it was designed was that the discussion forums actually weren't threaded. They were multiple pages. So if you wanted to go back to an instructor post, a student posting from 2 days ago, you had to flip through all these different pages and try to remember what page it was on. Of course, every day more and more messages are being added to these pages and there's more and more pages. So, you know, to put it quite honestly, it was a real nightmare. And of course, we didn't have a lot of time. It was a 4-week course. We were, you know, we had full-time jobs at our own institutions. We didn't have a lot of time to go hunting around for student posts. So what happened is we totally changed our approach, where we used any communication we had with students, we just did an announcements form, which would only allow an instructor to post. And as a result, it evolved into a much more teacher-centered interaction, obviously, because we were, you know, forced to not reply in these, you know, the student forums, and just direct all our interaction to this teacher-only space. So I think that's probably the most obvious example of how technology influenced teaching presence. But of course, there's also an example of how the technology itself positioned the instructor in a certain way. In this case, in the Spanish case, I was being positioned as I was being labeled by the technology, the CMS, as a primary tutor. But of course, and I haven't talked about this, but I mean, I posted very little because Spanish was just taking, you know, it was taking a lot of time to compose a message in Spanish, which is my third language. And it was just, and coupled with this technology problem with the CMS, I was hardly posting at all. So I really wasn't behaving like a primary tutor. And I felt that I was conforming to a very illegitimate position, really. I didn't really have a place to be a primary tutor. I didn't speak the language very well. I couldn't explain myself very well. And on top of all, you know, it was Linda who was posting the most, and she was an auxiliary tutor. And then we also have a case of Daniel who just was so disliked the WebCT discussion forum space that he actually, you know, tried moving some of that active interaction out into his weblog. Daniel was a very seasoned weblogger. His weblogs, you know, read by people all over the world. So he's very active in the weblog community as well. And you know, what was interesting about Daniel's case was that he actually tried to transfer his weblog practices, his interaction style, to the discussion forum, and you know, of course, that there is evidence for that both in his discussions and also in his interviews. So, just to summarize here, again, we talked about the blue, but additionally, what was interesting was that instructors in the same course can experience different tensions. Perhaps that's a bit obvious, but maybe it's not so obvious in some ways. So in the cases of co-instructors, they obviously experienced very different things. And instructors were also drawing on resources and making adjustments to the division of labor to address tensions and constraints. So this sort of reflects the whole agency component. The instructors did have agency in almost all of the cases, except for one, and they exercised it and got around these tensions, addressed these tensions, and again, that reflects the whole dynamic nature of the activity system. Now, as a result of this, I felt like there was a need to define teaching and presence within a sociocultural paradigm. And this is what I proposed in my dissertation, that, you know, if we're talking about teaching presence, perhaps what we're talking about is a negotiation of instructor interactions within a mediated context with the object of attending to student learning. So I put that out there for thought. It's welcome to comments. And as a conclusion, without going into detail about implications, et cetera, I think for me what really jumped out is, you know, what about best practices? I mean, how do you even talk about best practices if you're adopting a sociocultural perspective of teaching presence, really? Because these, as we've seen, there's so many things that are influencing what's going on, and there's considerable negotiation that's happening that instructors engaging in as in the practice of online teaching. So in terms of being able to adopt best practices, I question whether that's really productive even at this point. But again, I put it out there with a question, and I see that there's hopefully enough time for questions, and I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Tanis. And I'm opening the floor here to anybody with questions or comments for Tanis. Or if you have some comments even on her definition here that she put forth.
Thanks. Sorry, I'm the first time in Illuminate. I'm not sure whether I'm actually getting this right. Hi, I'm Rachel Holloway. I'm at the Northern Ontario School of Medicine in Sudbury in Ontario. And I have sort of question, sort of comment, sort of suggestion around some of the theoretical frames that you've been putting into your work. And I would just appreciate some ideas of whether you consider them or whether they might be useful. And that was maybe problematizing the community of inquiry piece and along the same lines that people have problematized the Wengren-Lave model about it being presented as a fairly idealized way of dealing with things, particularly the way Etienne Wenger's taken communities of practice as if it were always a beneficial thing. And looking, therefore, at something that was more more neutral, more critically engaged. And as I was listening to you, I was thinking about more anthropological models and thinking about people like Geert Hofstede, who has this model of cultural competence and cultural models that's much more of a relativistic model. He looks at issues of power distance, of individualism against collectivism, to what extent you can accept uncertainty. And it was particularly noticeable when you were talking about being able to think or behave or act differently using a different language, or being able to reconstruct or re-co-construct your approach to teaching and learning in that context, that something that has that broader perspective, that anthropological perspective, might be more useful. And I was also wondering to what extent you looked at metaphor theory for people like George Lakoff. Even in the organizational context, people like Gareth Morgan, who have looked at metaphors as the base construct of the reality, particularly around issues of culture and performance. I'll let you answer at that point.
Wow, thank you. First of all, I'll try and make sure I'm addressing all of your comments, and I appreciate the examples you gave, actually. So just to start, the Leben-Wenger, as part of this dissertation, I had to actually choose between the two frameworks because they are the more dominant ones in social cultural theory. And I think that in discussing Leben-Wenger, and I was influenced quite a bit by Nardi as well, I agree with you, I don't really see it as, what I found really interesting about Leben-Wenger's was the whole idea of legitimate peripheral participation and the fact that, you know, people can be marginalized. And that was the sort of takeaway point for me, and you can obviously see that reflected here. But for me, it didn't really get at the context in quite the way that activity theory does, which is why activity theory to me seemed a much more robust theory, even though it's also a bit more of a brain buster. It's a little hard to get your head around. Now, in terms of the ones that you referred to, the anthropological ones, I don't have any background at all in anthropology, and as a result, I think those ones sort of get ignored, especially, you know, I'm in language education. We tend to use the theories that go with that discipline, and perhaps that's good, perhaps that's bad. But I am quite intrigued by I think you mentioned Hofstede, it sounds very interesting, but just the language that was being used in describing that sounds really familiar. It sounds a lot like, you know, some of the language that's being used with activity theory, and I do recognize that activity theory seems to have many offshoots. I haven't really quite got my head around it. I'd love someone to draw a conceptual map of that and just make some sense of it, because, you know, of course, we're also hearing these other theories coming about that really seem to sort of resemble activity theory as well. So I'm not sure if that answers your questions. In terms of cultural competence and that sort of thing, in my field we talk a lot about, I can mention Byrum, Crampsch, Thorne, but again, I think Crampsch and Thorne increasingly, it's Thorne for sure, is they're all adopting activity theory. So forgive me if I haven't addressed all of your points, but I appreciate the new angle that you've given me, and I would love to actually see those references somewhere and that I could follow up with, and perhaps that can be done on a discussion board or something.
Thanks, Tanith. I'm going to jump in and let Bill have the mic now. He was next on the waiting list.
Thank you. I'm glad that at the end of your talk you came to your tentative formulation of a definition, because teacher presence is not something that I've thought about a lot as a particular concept. And so then as I listened to you, I kept asking, well, what does she really mean by teacher presence? And one notion I think that some people have is that in a way the teacher herself or himself is actually part of the curriculum. So teacher presence becomes the way that the teacher is seen by the participants as engaged with the subject, the way the teacher draws others into community and so on, just the way they are as a person, as something to be learned. And I'm wondering to what extent that notion of teacher as part of the curriculum of the course, whether implicit or explicit, is part of your notion, whether that came out in your case studies.
Absolutely. It's well, mainly because activity theory requires that. Again, it comes back to the unit of analysis, and curriculum then, if it was positioned in the activity theory framework, would refer to the rules, division of labor. I mean, in fact, you could probably say the whole, depending on your definition of curriculum, you could probably say the whole activity system is, to some extent, the curriculum. So, I mean, there's many ways of sort of shrinking and expanding activity theory, and I didn't really get into that at all. What I presented was just sort of one particular snapshot as a way of getting a handle on what I was actually talking about. But of course, third generation activity theory talks a lot about networks of activity systems, and those are related to any of the components in the framework, and particularly we seem to talk about, you know, the subject's own networks. So I think that, you know, from what you're saying, I think that, yeah, I think that is addressed to some extent in activity theory, but again, perhaps not well described as I've described it.
Did that answer your question, Bill?
Well, it's part of it. I guess there's another question that goes beyond that, which is in terms of distance education, what is the larger problem that this particular problem that you've studied is trying to solve? What is it that we don't know about distance education that we need to know that will help us improve our practice? So it's the sort of the meta question of your thesis.
I think that to that I'm going to refer to another student that at my institution who completed her dissertation last year, and her name is Olga Basharina. What she found in a tricultural activity with students located in Mexico, in Japan, and in Canada, that basically what she found was, and she actually adjusted the activity theory framework to reflect that, was that in this distance education context that I'm describing, students' local and global contexts had a huge influence on actually how they interacted. And I think in distance education, we talk about this a bit. We know that access is an issue, for example. So if your student in Russia doesn't have good internet access, of course, that's going to shift the activity system. But also just in terms of how their own sociocultural identities and how they interacted as a result of that was also a component. Now, I guess to give you a more concrete example, and I didn't refer to it here, in my own study, we had a case of non-participation in the online academy. And what happened is that we tried to get at, we had a lot of students not participating, but we had a core group of, you know, maybe, I don't know, 20% who were participating a lot. And we tried to get a better understanding of this by, you know, interviewing the program directors. We interviewed some students, and then we also just reflected on our own interpretation of it. And we had three very different interpretations. We thought, as instructors located in Canada, that it was a language issue, that these students were having a hard time interacting because English wasn't their first language. The program directors thought that it was because these students came from very teacher-centered backgrounds, therefore constructivist-type group work wasn't really, you know, their thing, and they were having troubles adapting to that. But when you actually interviewed the students, they said, you know, we're just really busy. We have full-time jobs. You know, we're professors at our own institution. You know, language actually isn't an issue at all. And, you know, that's the reason why we didn't participate. So I think in a distance education context, it becomes really important to sort of identify these and reflect on these multiple perspectives that, you know, activity theory allows. Does that answer it a bit more?
Thank you.
I'm going to jump in here again because Rosario has been very patient. She had put her hand up quite a while ago with a question. So go ahead, Rosario, and grab the mic. Rosario, you just have to click on the microphone icon to talk and then click on it again when you're done. And if you don't have audio, you can text in your questions, okay?
Okay. Can you hear me now? Oh, perfect. Sorry. I think this is just my second time. Anyway, so thank you very much, Tanis, for the interesting presentation. And I think you've kind of answered the question I had in your latest intervention. But my question was basically because you stated that in your findings that language and technology had shaped teaching presence. And I was just wondering how the social cultural background of the learners actually shaped their teaching presence. And so anyway, so I think you kind of answered that question already. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Although I should mention, too, that one of the limitations of the study is really the focus was on the instructors. So, of course, yes, I did triangulate with some student interviews and that sort of thing, but really getting at the students themselves, I don't really think that that was done in this study.
I'm just looking back, Tanis, at a couple of the notes that have been made in the text box here because it's been flowing quite rapidly in there. And one group asked you for the source for the beware of the book image that you use. So perhaps you can type that in. And also, I love Cindy wrote that she likes to think of successful rather than best practices. The advantage of this term is that it minimizes the notion of correct ways of doing things, but capitalizes on the utility and feasibility of strategies within particular contexts. As well, successful suggests that the practice has been evaluated in a formal sense and that there is learning from the exercise. And I love that, Cindy. I think I'm going to borrow that phrase myself.
Yeah, I think I will too. I think that works a lot better. At my own institution, we actually talk about best practices a lot, and we even, on our knowledge base, set up all kinds of documents about best practice. So it was, I put that there partly in reaction to that a bit. In terms of the beware of the book image, okay, first of all, I should mention that my reference list, you'll notice it's missing a few references. And the same goes for the slide with the photo credits. Most of the photo credits are here. They did come from these three sources. But the beer of the book I got a long time ago from Flickr. So, and I'm not even sure what words I used to get it. And that was in the days when I actually didn't really document the source of the image. I felt like I could just grab it if they said I could. So I apologize for that. But there's a couple images in there. The one with the signs as well is also an old Flickr one.
Thanks, Tanis. Nellie had also asked, are we relating to full distance or blended learning? And I assume that question was for you. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nellie.
Yeah, all these cases were online, purely online distance contexts. There weren't any mixed mode contexts at all.
I'm just taking a moment here, Tanis, to scroll through some of the comments. Like I said, there's been some active texting going on back and forth here, and if there's any, actually maybe it would help if there's any questions in the text box that we haven't addressed, or if you have, can you please just bring our attention to it, or use the audio at this point?
I'm seeing at the bottom here, U of M, did I address instructors' concerns of time? So the time is actually discussed in the discussion section as well, because yeah, it does come into play, and part of the reason it comes into play is that really, with the exception of one case, all of the instructors had full-time jobs on the side, or this was a side job, so time is always a constraint for them. And the only case where, you know, the job was to teach the course is William, of course, who had a luxurious position as a full professor at a Canadian university. So time is definitely a huge constraint and a huge issue, and it also definitely affected not only how a course was designed, but also how the type of teaching presence that instructors adopted, for sure.
Thanks, Tanis. Nellie had her hand up next. Nellie, do you have audio today?
Yes, I do. I always do. I noticed that some of us, well, I got it clear because I'm familiar with the community of inquiry and blended learning, but I think that some may not be aware of the fact that teaching presence is not actually the teacher, but it could be the students, the peer, and it could also be the material. In other words, teaching is whatever comes through to the students and not just not by means of the teacher. So I think that should be clarified maybe for some of us. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, in this study, I do discuss that a little bit. And what I found in my literature review, though, is that even though that is stated in the original definition and article on teaching presence from 2001, I believe, I don't think I was able to find any study that actually really talks about students and teaching presence. So what I found was actually that most of the studies were really looking at the instructor and their teaching presence. So again, and part of the reasons for just focusing on that is that at some point I had to put some boundaries to the study. It was already 6 cases. And I, again, even from an activity theory perspective, you know, of course it's incomplete. All I did was focus on the instructor, but of course you can swap the subject with the students or, you know, with a co-instructor or whatever and have a totally different perspective on what went on. And I did see in the comments there that some people were talking a little bit about, you know, well, what about the student's perception of instructor presence? Probably very different from the instructor's. And absolutely, and I think that's, I think activity theory almost requires that you do look at that. It's the system is, you know, quote unquote multi-perspectival, so and multi-voiced, and it's important to get at that multi-voiced perspective.
Thanks, Tanis. I think I better take a moment here because it's a few minutes after the hour, and thank you for taking the time to share your PhD research with us. It's been very interesting, and it's for such a quiet group, it sure drew a lot of discussion in the end. So I'm very happy for you that you got that kind of feedback, too, and practice before you do your dissertation. And before we lose too many more participants, I would just like to point out and remind everybody that our next CIDR session takes place on Friday, April 11th. And we have Ishmael Cana-Lopez, who will be here from the Open University of Catalonia to speak about the personal research portal. For those of you who've checked the CIDR website, he had written an original article, and they are posted on the CIDR site, about the personal research portal, and then recently extended that article to take into consideration the virtual faculty and the classroom, and so forth. Unfortunately, that newer article is only in Spanish, so we'll be getting the first English version here on April 11th, so I hope you can join us for that. And thank you again, Tanis, and I'm not sure how much time you have still to stand around and chat out in the hall, so to speak, so let us know.
First of all, I just want to thank everybody for their great questions and for your patience in helping me articulate this verbally, which I haven't had to do in a long, long time. And I'm going to take some time as well to just go through some of the questions in the chat, because I think as we were going through, I was trying not to lose my focus there, but I think there's some great comments in the chat section as well. And I'm certainly happy to stick around for, another 10, 15 minutes or so to answer any more questions. It benefits me, so it's really not a problem at all.
Okay, well then I will open the floor and let anyone who has any more questions or comments grab the microphone, okay?